It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, glad you could be here. As teens live more of their lives online, researchers wonder about the degree of online racial discrimination they encounter in these virtual spaces, and then what the ripple effect is on academic performance and the emotional well-being of adolescents of color. Call in at any point with your questions about youth exposure to racial harassment and discrimination, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Alvin Thomas is a clinical psychologist and an assistant professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Studies and the Phyllis Northway Faculty Fellow at the School of Human and Ecology at UW-Madison. Alvin, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. Thank you for welcoming me back and for inviting me to be with you this morning.
Well, let's start with your survey. You surveyed over 350 Black and Hispanic teens across America. What did you hear from your respondents?
So we heard a number of things. So we asked them about their physical health. We asked them about their psychological health, so mental health issues. We asked them about their social media use. And it's pretty interesting, a lot of it in keeping with what we already know about how Black and Hispanic teens and also white teens use social media. So very high levels of social media use across all teens, but significantly higher use for among Black and Hispanic teens. But we also did see some negative effects of social media use on both the mental health and academic health of Black and Hispanic teens. But we did surprisingly see a positive effect for social media use over to academic outcomes for youth. And we could talk a little bit about what that positive effect might have looked like.
Let's put a peg in that for just a moment. Did you feel like the teens were being honest with you about their responses?
I think generally, because it is anonymous, teens are more likely to report very accurately. We generally trust teens' report because it's, one, because it's anonymous, two, because they're doing it without the parent looking over their shoulders. We tell them exactly how to kind of protect their privacy around that information. There is, of course, some expectation, in small ways, where teens might over-report or under-report because of one reason or another. But in general, I think the science generally appreciates and values teens' reports about their own activities and their own health.
How did you reach these teens? Where did you find them?
It's amazing. So there are a number of different platforms on which and services that allow you to be able to tap into teens who are currently using sites. Very often we have survey type resources that are able to tell you where these teens are and can advertise surveys to them and say, hey, here's a survey that is seeking to explore these particular issues. Are these issues that you're interested in? Are these issues that are meaningful to you? Would you like to take a survey? And here is a small reward if you decide to take that survey. And so that's where we found most of these teens, in those very spaces that they are occupying and are reporting that they're using.
When you look at the survey results, especially with social media, what differences did you see on the effects of gender and social media?
So we definitely saw a much larger... Let me step back a little bit.
Sure.
So we explored three different indices of social media use. We wanted to know how much time kids were spending on social media, the number of accounts they had on social media, and the kinds of activities that they said they were doing, whether they were showing up just to see what was going on, just browsing, whether they were clicking, just like and unlike and or posting, what kinds of activities they were doing. And across those three, we saw significantly higher total social media use among Black and Hispanic teens. When we looked at gender differences, we saw that female adolescents had far more accounts than male adolescents. We saw a slightly higher In the number of activities or the range of activities that girls use, that girls engage in than boys, but it wasn't significant. But the biggest difference, I think, gender-wise, was the number of accounts, with girls having significantly more accounts than boys.
You must have wondered why that is. What might be going on?
We're trying to figure that out as well. We're not sure if it is that girls are a little bit more social, a little bit more widespread or dispersed in their networks, the kinds of individuals that they're interacting with, the places that their friends might be, the kinds of activities that they're involved in might require them to be on dispersed networks, while boys might be more centric, might be more centered on one or two activities or on one or two friend groups. Versus girls who have maybe significantly more or larger social networks. We think that that could be one possibility, but again, we would have to go back in and ask some of these teens, who are they online with? What are they doing online? Kind of do a deeper
A deeper
dive, a deeper
dive.
dig into what's going on there.
We're talking about teens and social media use, the implications, the effects. Alvin Thomas is an assistant professor at UW Madison's Department of Human Development and Family Studies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Alvin, you did say that there were some positive impacts on social media use, but to step back, what does past research say about the effects of online racial discrimination, online harassment on kids and teens in these online spaces and in these virtual communities?
So we know that in physical spaces, experiences with discrimination can significantly impact both the mental health, the academic health, and just overall health for youth and for individuals who experience it. We wanted to try to understand whether or not in this increasingly virtual digital space that youth are exploring and are inhabiting, whether or not that risk existed in much the same way and operated in much the same way. So we were expecting to see some potential negative outcomes. And I think that's exactly what we found. We found that the increases in or the higher levels of online racial discrimination were related to higher levels of both depression and anxiety, whether it's related to other elements of mental health. We have not looked at that for these data yet. We would have to kind of look at additional data to see if we see those same relationships. But the prevailing literature does suggest that there is that same negative impact from online discrimination to a number of outcomes for youth in the virtual or digital space, much like or representative of what we would see in the physical space. What might be interesting is to compare those two and see whether or not the impact of online discrimination over and above discrimination in the physical space, whether that is significantly more impactful. That's something that we've not done yet.
And I wonder too, especially from the responses, how can you measure the amount and degree of the hatred they are experiencing online? Like, how do you measure that?
So, I think if we wanted to do that, we would have to do maybe focus groups or individual interviews. And in this case, we didn't do that. We were doing objective measures. So we were asking youth to tell us in the last, give them a specific period, in the last time period, how many times did these specific did you experience these specific activities? And we listed the 10 top discrimination type experiences, and kids would identify which ones they had experienced in that period of time. A previous study by another colleague found that, and that's among about 101 African American adolescents. Those adolescents reported about 5,606 experiences, and that average to about 5 daily experiences. Now, we would agree that just one experience is more than enough to rattle you for the day, to throw your day off. Imagine having going through not one, not two, not three, but 5 experiences average daily of these kinds of discriminatory, very irascible kinds of experiences. For our study, we had a similar average of experiences as well.
UW-Madison Assistant Professor in the School of Human Ecology, Alvin Thomas, studies the effects of online racial harassment on Black and Hispanic teens. Call in with your questions about online racism or other toxic content and encounters. Share what you want to know, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, clinical psychologist and UW-Madison assistant professor in the Department of Human Development and Family Studies. Alvin Thomas, he examines the frequency and impact of online racial discrimination or harassment, surveyed hundreds of Black and Hispanic teens. Latest findings are published in the Journal of Youth and Adolescence. Call in with your questions at any point about social media hate speech, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Alvin, you gave us a morsel, just a bit of a crumb earlier, that there were some positive implications of social media use. What did you find?
So we usually think of social media as this horrible space that we should try to keep adolescents from. And what we're finding is that social media is a socializing space. It's a space where teens inhabit and learn and interact with their peers, with the world, learn how the world functions. And so we can't keep them away from it. We have to pretty much help them understand and navigate that space. So we found that youth who had used social media more had higher perceptions or more positive beliefs about their abilities, their academic abilities. And we think what might be happening, we didn't explore this, we think what might be happening is that some of these youth are using social media as a way of subsidizing and supporting their learning, as a resource for ideas, a resource for exploring ideas, finding new ideas, learning new things. But it is when they have these negative experiences, these online harassment or online racial discrimination experiences, that what could be a positive space suddenly starts to take a negative turn in their development.
It can turn toxic very quickly, just
exactly,
with one act, one incident. Your paper also looks at something called critical consciousness, and I'm wondering if you can introduce us with that concept and explain why it's important to talk about this process in development.
So I think that was a teaser in the conversation article, but we did have a paper that came out recently, soon after this first one, that did look at the impact of online racial discrimination on critical consciousness. And so that might be a different conversation. But when we think of critical consciousness, we're talking about adolescents or individuals engaging in civic conversation or conversation around issues that relate to their daily lives, their daily social lives and interaction with their political systems, with their economic systems, with their societal institutions. And so whether that means the individual's belief in their ability to change or to impact those systems, those institutions, that would be critical agency. And whether it is that they actually go on to take some action, whether it be protest or writing to a senator, or creating groups where they can discuss these issues, that would be critical action. And so there is both critical action and critical agency develop throughout our lives. In some spaces, it's stronger, it's higher. So I think we probably saw a lot of critical action and critical agency for Black and Hispanic youth, especially around the George Floyd murder. We saw it a little bit during the pandemic, and we saw it across the board for all youth who were beginning to engage in protests, were engaging in demonstrations, engaging in conversations around the school shootings, around the pandemic, a number of issues where student voices rose in response to some kind of perceived social failure or social inadequacy.
Looking at the circle around these teens, these Black and Hispanic teens, how can parents and caregivers digest your survey results and help kids navigate these online spaces?
So I think it's ultimately that is the aim of my work and of this paper specifically. It's to provide some support for public policymakers, for teachers, for parents specifically, to try to figure out exactly how they may be able to protect and support kids. One of the easiest takeaways is know what your children are doing. In much the same way that you wouldn't just let your kid walk out the door and not know where they're going and who they're going to be with, in much the same way when we let our kids get on their phones or on their computers to get online, we need to know where they're going and what they're doing. So do some monitoring at the very basic level, do some monitoring, whether that be through some kind of device or some kind of program or algorithm that you set, like a kid lock or something like that, or talk to your child. Talk to your child about what safe internet use looks like. Talk to them about the pitfalls of improper internet use, and create space so that your child feels comfortable coming to tell you about their own experiences, both positive and negative experiences, and be willing to keep to be quiet and listen to what they're telling you, and then spend some time creating space and creating a narrative around what they're sharing with you and helping them navigate some of those troubling experiences, if that ever comes to that.
Keeping those communication lines open.
Exactly.
Alvin Thomas here, as we talk about the effects of online racism on teens of color. Alvin Thomas, a clinical psychologist and an assistant professor at UW-Madison. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Governor Tony Evers called 2023 the year of mental health in his State of the State address and proposed millions of dollars for school mental health services. How could state funding best support the mental health of Black and Hispanic teens?
So I think we might be a little bit behind the ball, and I don't think it's just a Wisconsin thing. I think it's a countrywide thing. We did not prepare ourselves adequately for what I still think is a looming mental health crisis down the line, coming off of the COVID crisis, the COVID pandemic, lockdowns and anxiety related to the death and protests related to the murder of George Floyd. I think part of what has to happen is we have to be willing to put the money behind some of these issues, to fund resources that allow students to be able to find support when they need it. Often there's a disparity between the sheer weight of activity and experiences and easy accessible resources. I think critical is easy and accessible resources, and that sometimes means resources within the community, not just in the school spaces, but going into the community and infusing those resources in there.
I wonder, Alvin Thomas, you know, your research is really centered on improving the lives of kids, of Black boys and Black fathers. Also, where do you take your research from here?
We have a number of avenues that we're exploring. So we're going to continue looking at this social media issue, this social media space as a socialization space, as I said, and continue looking at what the risks look like. But even more important than the risk, I'm always interested in what are some of the things that parents, teachers, and others are already doing that is helping to build resilient kids, and how can we upscale some of these things that are already being done. And then how can we now also subsidize it with new skills, new coping mechanisms? So I'm going to continue exploring that. We recently released the Black Fatherhood podcast around Juneteenth and Father's Day of last year. And we're going to get ready to put together a second round or second season of that podcast to explore specifically the challenges for Black fatherhood, the experiences for Black fatherhood, but also the unspoken benefits for fatherhood in general, but in this case, fatherhood specifically. Mm. So looking at both of those spaces is going to be what's going to continue happening for this year and probably into next year as well.
Alvin, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Alvin Thomas, clinical psychologist and assistant professor in the Department of Human Development at UW-Madison. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the cherished French baguette and how to craft European pastries. Call in about French breads, desserts that transport you to Paris. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Jean Webb, owner and head baker of North Shore Boulangerie. Let's take call now. Jeff in Milwaukee. Jeff, hi.
Hi. So my question is about, like, when to visit a boulangerie. I'm assuming that a bunch of bread comes out of the oven in the morning, but is there, like, another shift of baking that gets done? When would you suggest coming by to get the best bread?
Jeff, thank you so much. Jean?
When your bakery is kind of operating on the classy schedule, first thing in the morning is the best time. And especially for a baguette, the long shape where there's a high surface to volume ratio, they dry very quickly. They're not a bread with a very long shelf life. So first thing in the morning, a baguette shouldn't be eaten straight out of the oven. That's something you do with American style bread. French breads need to sit on a wire rack for an hour or 2 hours, but usually the baguettes are out of the oven at least that long, maybe 2 hours before the shop opens, and then the baguettes are ready to go. The crust is at its crispiest, all the flavor from that browning reaction on the surface has worked its way into the crumb. Excess moisture from the crumb has worked its way out, and the crust has recrisped itself. It happens quite naturally. And so in those first couple hours when the bakery's open, it's the best time to go get a baguette. Some bakeries, if they're large enough, and we're not a huge bakery, they can sometimes do a second round of baking, but by and large, we don't. There is sometimes people will re-crisp a baguette, and that's something you can do at home quite nicely.
Yes. But how would you suggest reviving a baguette that's gone a little hard?
Well, once it's hard, it's almost over.
Okay. The relationship is no good anymore.
Right. You've got croutons at that point, okay, or crostini. But if the baguette has gone a little soft, which depending on the time of year, right, in August, that often happens. If your hydration level is a little bit high, the excess moisture can come out and soften the crust again a couple hours later. Toss it into a hot oven. What I tell customers is that, 400 degrees, 350, 400 degrees, and hold it in your oven until you start to see a little additional color coming on. If you see additional color coming on, pull it out. But then again, let it rest for an hour or so before you try to serve it.
Can we introduce the freezer here? Is there a best way to freeze dough or to preserve it for future baking?
The dough itself, no. Okay. The baked product. There are doughs that can be frozen. I've never tried to freeze baguette dough. I'm afraid that would, the impact on the yeast would be too detrimental. The proofing and everything would probably be bad or not sufficient to get you what you want. But if you have a baguette that's on the lighter side and you want to hang on to it, wrap it up very tightly so that, today we have frost-free freezers, which means they're pulling moisture out of the freezer cabinet. And they'll pull moisture out of your whatever you put in it, unless you wrap it up real well. And then you can hang on to it. Bread freezes quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And then bring it out. Baguettes, you sometimes can go straight from freezer to oven because they're thin enough and small enough for the heat to penetrate. Larger shaped breads probably should bring to room temperature before you try to put them back in the oven.
Okay, good to know. My colleague Trina wrote in a really wonderful note, has been making baguettes almost every week since they went to France at the end of last year, making them using a gluten-free brown rice sourdough starter, psyllium husk, brown rice flour, potato starch, olive oil, and salt, and says, gotta have the baguette pan for ultimate crispness. Can you talk about adapting the traditional baguette for gluten-free or other sensitive diets?
Right. The set of adjustments that you just described would probably absolutely require the use of a baguette pan, those shaped pans that have they're troughs that are perforated.
Mm-hmm.
But classically baguettes, and that's because the recipe that you just described is probably on the weaker side. The dough doesn't have a lot of strength, so it needs a pan to provide its shape until it can be baked. Classically, baguettes are not done in pans like that. They're proofed on what's called couche, which is French for diaper. It's a cloth, a floured cloth. So it has to be able to hold itself up even during the proofing process. But it also, once it goes into the oven, it has to hold itself up. It goes the dough directly onto the stone without any support around it. So when you make those sort of adjustments and you do those sorts of things because the dough would be a little bit weaker and would require some support. But yeah, it's
possible.
It is possible. You just make further adjustments.
You mentioned mixers a little bit ago. What utensils or what is really helpful to have on hand when making baguettes?
I think one of the mixers, a mixer with a good strong motor, if you're going to do this frequently. A lot of the mixers today that are on the commercial market for home use have lighter weight motors because for most people, they're just doing batters and meringues, which don't take much power. So try to get a good quality mixer. If you can get a dough hook that is not rounded but is flat, that's helpful also. A flatter dough hook can actually grab the dough as it's mixing and stretch it, which is really what creates the strength. And this is going to sound silly, but one of the most important things is once you have a baguette proof, you somehow have to get it into the oven, and you're working with basically this soft, delicate, really, really delicate noodle, large noodle, right? So you've got to be able to maneuver around the kitchen. So get a baguette flipper, or you can go to Home Depot and get a long flat board and be able to move your baguette around that way. The most frustrating, I think, at home is when you've gone through this entire process and there you have this beautifully proofed baguette loaf that is
a work of art,
something longer than 20 inches long, and you have to stand there and figure out how you're going to get this unwieldy thing into the oven without destroying it. It's even probably more important than the mixer. is to have some way to get that baguette into the oven onto the stone.
My blood pressure is going up as you say that. We're talking about French baguettes and baking with Jean Webb, French-trained baker in the greater Milwaukee area, business owner. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Christina in Glenwood City. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. Can you describe the French sablé cookie and offer advice or even a quick recipe to make them to perfection?
Sablé cookies, yes. You know, it's a sort of shortbread. We make a sablé every sablé stars. We just made a whole bunch of them for the holidays. If you look up on Amazon, a French pastry chef by the name of Jackie Pfeiffer. He's an Alsatian baker, so around Strasbourg, so that's why a Frenchman has a name like Pfeiffer. But he is one of the kind of world-known pastry chefs. And in his cookbook that he won a Beard Award for, actually, the cookbook that came out a couple of years back. It was before the pandemic. And he has just a wonderful sablé recipe in that book.
I think I like them dipped in chocolate, or, you know, you can make them in different ways, right?
Oh, absolutely. A sablé dough is very, very versatile.
Uh-huh.
Ours, for example, we put cardamom in it, flavor it that way. But sablé dough is used for tart shells, for cookies. It's a type of consistency, sablé, the type of crumbling that it does, and the technique for getting the butter worked into it.
Mm, I need one right now with a cup of tea. I'd be good to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, speaking of recipes, you shared a couple. One was for a baguette, which I appreciate because it's day one and day two. Mm-hmm. in the baguette with Louvain. I think that means leaven. Is that right? The culture there?
Right. It's the yeast culture. Wild yeast culture.
Can you walk us a little bit through the day one and day two? Give us a sense of what's involved.
So, you know, day one, it will be familiar to anyone who does sourdough baking. You know, leaven is sort of the French cousin, or our sourdough culture is the American cousin to the French leaven. Day one is you're just getting the culture up and active. Leaven is, and as well as sourdough cultures, are these wonderful, wonderful self-balancing populations of about 30, at least 30 different microbes. 10 different yeast, the predominant one being Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is what we think of as bread yeast and brewer's yeast. And then at least 20 different bacteria. And so that culture needs to be fed. It's fed with flour. So you need to, it needs to be active. Our grandparents and great-grandparents, they often kept these growing, and they were growing every day. For a home baker now who may not do it every day, you need to at least take a day to get your yeast culture up and growing and active.
And this is your bread and butter, because I want to step in and say you hold a doctorate in yeast genetics.
Surprisingly, as that happened, it wasn't a connection that I made until later in life. So yeah, absolutely. I find it remarkably interesting from multiple perspectives. But yeah, but the most interesting perspective is the flavor that comes out of these fermentation processes. That, you know, all those microbes working together, they balance out the population, and each one has a different role to play. Right, the bacteria that are in natural, we think of sour cultures or leaven cultures as yeast, but there's a lot of bacteria in there. They handle the really complex starches and mm-hmm. break it down, so that the yeast, who prefer simpler sugars, simpler starches, just like us, as our GI tract and as our physiology works, and they just do wonderful things. Mankind has, I mean, maybe the leaven should have UNESCO designation.
I knew that was coming.
I'm not sure who you'd give credit for. I mean, that there's folklore around that whole thing, but yeah, exactly. So yeah, day one, getting those microbes up and running, having them happy and growing at a good speed and having the population all balanced. And then using that culture to leaven your baguette. Traditionally, early on, although, I mean, today, a lot of baguette recipes only use quick rise yeast and powdered yeast. But early on, all bakeries used these Laban. Mm. When times get tough, I think we can still go back to that. I know, for example, when the pandemic hit, we were going, the supply chains were getting stretched and there was no yeast, no quick rise yeast, which is used in other products. And so we reworked our recipe so that we could use what we were growing in the shop to make sure we could keep the products running.
Wow. That's really interesting. Jean Webb runs two French style bakeries in Milwaukee's North Shore suburbs. Call in with your questions about the craft of bread making or share what you've learned in the kitchen. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On the heels of France's iconic long bread loaf, the baguette, achieving cultural heritage status, we explore the art of bread making. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Jean Webb is here, owner and head baker of North Shore Boulangerie, with two locations in the Milwaukee suburbs. So, Jean, you know, how do you know you've got a good culture in day one of the recipe to take that sour culture into day two and be confident with it?
The easiest way is to, once you, on day one, as you're providing the culture with fresh water and fresh flour, you should start to see the culture expand as the yeast and the bacteria grow and the yeast are producing CO2. You should see your culture within, I'd say, 2 hours or so. You should see it start growing. And actually, this is an excellent point. Whatever vessel you feed it in should be clean, without any soap or sterilization residue, because that'll harm the microbes. But it should also be big enough to allow the culture to expand so that you're not, your culture doesn't kind of overtop whatever jar you're putting it in. But yeah, within 2 to 3 hours, you should start seeing it rise up and grow and get bubbly.
Okay. I want to just jump in here with Tom in Dubuque, Iowa. Tom, hi, go ahead.
Hello, good morning. Pleasure listening to your show. I have both successfully and unsuccessfully baked bread before, but I wondered if you could give some recommendations on coming up with your own sourdough starter and how best to feed that and when, how long it can be stored in the refrigerator before use. Thank you.
Excellent questions. It's very satisfying to start your own sourdough culture, but you have to be very, very patient. As I mentioned before, it's a self-balancing population of up to 30, maybe 40 microbes, depending on where you're at in the country. So when you first start, I mean, basically, if you just take a vessel with flour and water, it's a half flour, half water. That's considered by baker percentages to be 100% hydration. Microbes in the air will seed that flour and water mixture. But because the bacteria tend to grow much faster, they're much simpler and will initially outcompete any yeast that fall in there, your culture will be quite frightening for about the first 2 weeks. It will smell terrible because bacteria don't really smell good to us. But persevere and don't run. In time, sometimes 2 weeks, sometimes 3 weeks, sometimes 4 weeks, the yeast will start to get a foothold, and then the population will balance out. You can help yourself a couple of ways to maybe help this process along a little bit faster. You can drop dried fruit or fresh fruit organic, unwashed fruit into the culture, and sometimes a little bit of malt syrup, because the yeast like the simple sugars, whereas the bacteria like the more complex starches. And so how the fruit helps is that if you've ever been out in the orchard and you picked an apple and you look at it, and it looks cloudy and you think it's just dust or dirt or schmutz, and you polish it on your shirt and eat the apple, that film, most of it is actually wild yeast. So if you can get an organic fruit that has not been washed, and drop it in, you're actually inoculating the culture with these wonderful wild yeast. So you can help the process along, but really it's be brave, persevere. And in time, it may take a couple of weeks, but that culture will balance itself out. That does mean that initially every couple of days, you're gonna start with a fresh vessel with flour and water, 50-50, and then add a little bit of the previous culture. It's important to keep feeding it fresh, but it will, as I said, in a couple of weeks, give you a beautiful Lavan or sourdough culture that is quite specific to your region, the terroir of that of your area, and will give you a wonderful bread.
Tom, does that help?
It does very much. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. We only have a few moments left, but I just want to acknowledge the other recipe you sent along our way. Find them at WPR.org/mornings. But the French country white bread with fermented dough. Any highlights you can share about this recipe?
The fermented dough is probably the first way that bakers leaven bread. Yeah, and it's a pre-ferment like Lavan or sourdough. But it allows you to get started right away. You don't have an ongoing culture. You use dry yeast, make some dough, let it ferment, let the yeast grow, chill it, and then you use that chilled dough the next day to start in. And in those 24 to 48 hours, the solo kind of monoculture of S. cerevisiae will be able to undertake enough fermentation to provide you with a beautiful, beautiful flavor.
Okay, so would you consider that to be a bit of a gateway bread to bake to try out if you haven't been baking much before?
Right, absolutely, because it's the shape is it's a batard, so it can fit in your hand. It's not so intimidating to move around the kitchen. It's a tight crumb bread with a nice French crust, but not the really aggressive crust that you usually want in a baguette. So yeah, I think it is. I think it would be a wonderful gateway drug.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Gene, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Gene Webb is owner and head baker of North Shore Boulangerie. We have a link to the baguette. We have a link to the French country white bread recipes. They're on our program page, WPR.org/mornings, to check them out. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back.